I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In all my years as both a male model and world best doctor, nothing has prepared me for this.
I'm the quirky one the audience will come to love.
Is everyone clear of the hospital?
Yes, McHandsome Face.
Usually I'd yell at you for calling me that, but this is a turning point in the series, so instead I'm going to smile at you as a single tear rolls down my very ruggedly handsome cheek.
Do you think we're going to make it?
I don't know. Some psychopath rigged this man with explosives, and if his heart stops, these explosives go off. And our hearts stop with it.
What do we have to do?
Scalpel. Pump 20 cc's of that heart juice stuff into the IV.
Do you know what you're doing?
Oh my god, ask me that again, and I'm gonna detonate the bomb on purpose. Okay, Curious George over here, let me work. God damn it.
Okay, jeez, pumping. Mr. McCranky Pants, more like, oh my god.
We're losing him. Hit him with the electric ping-pong paddles.
Clear! It's not working!
This is a wreck.
May the ghost of Meredith Grey have mercy on us all.
All right, what's going on, guys? Welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, who once dunked a basketball. I'm not going to let you forget that. Kyle Moore. And joining me, my spunky sidekick, also me.
I have so many issues with what you just said. I am fucking livid. But yeah, I'm Kyle's mental health, and I've dunked twice. So suck on that, you jolly green nobody.
That's untrue.
Is not.
Is so.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you smell.
You are not wrong. Guys, before we get going, I just want to give a shout out to Shania for the idea for this week's intro. She didn't have anything to plug, so this is really sweet. She wanted me to challenge you guys to go out of your way to do one random act of kindness this week.
Dude, that's so sweet. It's the sweetest fucking thing I've ever heard.
Right? Yeah, thanks, Shania. If you guys want to get a shout out on the podcast, all you got to do is follow us on Instagram at Life's Rec Podcast. Answer the question box on our story leading up to the release of the episode. And you can get an idea brought to life for an intro and get a little plug on the podcast. And I don't care what it is. It's like if you want to plug a book that you're reading, your YouTube channel, a store in your hometown, your OnlyFans, a peanut butter brand that you like, I don't care. I'll throw the plug up on the podcast because why not? You know, it's fun and I can do whatever I want. Also,
hey,
guys.
I got this.
So we covered this last
week.
Yeah,
we agreed that this is kind of my shtick. This is my thing.
Dude, I...
What are you doing? Stop it.
Fine. Oh, my God. Do the sponsor part. Jeez.
Oh, thanks, man. Really appreciate that. Where was I? Guys, have you ever heard of Tether? The men's peer support social network that's available on both Apple and Android. The platform with thousands of men connecting and supporting one another in an authentic and judgment-free environment. A place that compiles mental health resources and curates mental health-related dope-ass f***ing content, like, you know, this podcast. Literally, the only drawback from the platform is that other me also is on that platform. But even still, go download Tether in the App Store or Google Play Store today. Start connecting.
You know, I was going to give you some shit, but that was pretty good.
Why do you sound shocked?
Speaking of things that are just the best, you want to know what I love?
Mirrors, car windows, other people's eyes so that you can see your own reflection, like Big Brother Canada Twitter.
Okay, that was kind of cool. You gotta give me that. That was pretty funny to wake up to.
Yeah, thank God that Kyle Moore is like the most generic name ever. It gave your ego a little boost this morning.
To be honest, I don't even remember what I was talking about.
God, I'm going to so quickly take over this podcast the second that I get the chance.
Okay, wow. So I was going to say something I love is shooting the shit with the boys.
Okay, a given.
But this week on the podcast, I got to do that. But these buddies of mine just so happen, you know, funny coincidence, just so happen to also be working within the field of clinical psychology.
A couple modern day Fraser Cranes. Better looking, though. Better looking.
God, I love that show.
Yeah, of course you do.
This week on the podcast, I'm joined by my friends Alan Keon and Jeremy Forsyth. In 2016, Jeremy earned a Bachelor of Science at the University of Toronto. As an undergraduate, he developed a keen interest in all things psychology and philosophy. One topic that he became more focused on is this relationship between people's worldviews and vulnerability to mental illness. Currently, Jeremy is pursuing a Master's in Clinical Psychology at York University. Alan also earned a Bachelor of Science, but in 2019 from the University of Toronto, St. George. Alan developed an interest in clinical psychology and philosophy while studying under the legs of John Vervaeke and Jordan Peterson. Alan is interested in existential psychology, classic literature, and philosophy, and his research interests lie in emotional intelligence and emotion-focused therapy. Boys, man, it's been too long. I wish we could have done this in person, you know, had a couple beers while we did it, but I'm so stoked to have you guys on the podcast. So we'll start out pretty easy. How you doing?
Oh man, that is a loaded question.
Yeah.
Like I think it's on and off, dude. Like it's really on and off, like over the past year. You know, there's been a lot of like ups and downs. Obviously, the environment is like kind of out of control. But I would say overall I'm pretty good. I'm able to sort of like cope with the stress. Mm-hmm. And there's always a bad day here and there, but I think I've learned to effectively cope with the stress over the years.
I think that's like the nice sort of like diplomatic version of it. I'll go into depth a little bit of, yes, I have to echo Jeremy. I think he's right. There are more good days, I think, for us as we're engaged in what we're doing than bad days. The bad days would be when it feels like it's too much. You know what I mean? Like when the tasks that you have to do in front of you just kind of mount up and you let yourself maybe look too far ahead into the future. You look 2-3 weeks ahead in your schedule and you think, yeah, I don't know if this is like necessarily doable. And like anxiety starts seeping into the relaxation moments. And then, yeah.
It kind of, yeah, especially right now, I find that little things can kind of take over your whole state pretty quickly just because of how stressful everything already is. I feel like a lot of people are kind of on that hairline trigger, and those one little things can kind of throw you for a loop, which sucks. And from my own experience, is definitely the case. I'm really excited to have you guys on the podcast today because, first of all, you know, two guys that I know from Toronto, but also two guys who are going into this field that interests me a lot. And obviously, as people who are starting to practice and see patients, this is obviously like a very, you know, there's a learning curve and you guys are experiencing a lot within the psychology world right now. To kind of get us started, though, I'd love to hear a little bit of your backgrounds, why you guys wanted to go into psychology, and kind of what led to you guys being here today. So we'll start with Jeremy.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I started my undergrad in 2011, actually, kind of a long time ago. And I was at U of T. And, you know, that first year, I, like most, you know, undergrads in their first year, didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was taking like the most random courses, dude, like astronomy and anthropology, just like trying to like feel my way through academia and like going like, what am I really interested in? You know, I finally, over the course of like a year or two, like really sort of fell into the role of like wanting to learn more about philosophy, wanting to learn more about psychology. Those were my two babies. Those were like my passions.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly, I would say psychology, just because I'm fascinated by, you know, the human. It's one of the most complex, like, things that we know in the known universe. And then also on the, in the same vein, I don't know how deep you want me to go here, but
please,
one of these sort of like axioms of like who I am as a person is like my desire to alleviate the suffering of other people, you know, in whatever way that I can, not to like virtue signal or anything like that.
Right.
But it's just something that has always sat with me, something I've always wanted to strive for, which I think actually comes from this philosophical background of like analyzing suffering, analyzing sort of the existential aspects of human nature, analyzing, you know, the things that you can't take away from human life, you know,
right,
death, birth, suffering, these sorts of things. And so I just, you know, put everything into clinical psychology, doing like so I double majored in philosophy and psychology in grad, and I was fascinated by existentialism, which is like a philosophical school of thought that like deals with the givens of existence, things that like every single person has to experience universally. Things like we're all born in like a specific time, in a specific place. You know, you can't choose your birth. You know, we all die. We all have to suffer. We all have like the freedom to choose who we're going to be. These sorts of things like fascinated me. And I came to sort of at least my own philosophical conclusion that the only thing that I can really fall back on is that suffering is bad. And so I like, I guess, like use that as the infrastructure for like my purpose in life, which is to alleviate the suffering of other people, which would be it, like, I guess, good, you know.
That's really interesting. That's a really cool way to look at it. We'll get more into that in, sure, in a little bit. Alan, how about you?
So myself, it didn't start off so philosophically. It was definitely good over bad. So I knew I wanted to go towards help. And so I did what everyone that enters a U of T undergrad does, which is think I'm going to get into med school. And I took, I took a bunch
of... Buy a Canada Goose jacket and think you're going to get into med school.
Exactly. guilty. So I did that. And I also had to fill out a humanities thing, which had always been not a passion of mine. So I took the psychology course and I ended up getting some like unbelievably high mark. Mm-hmm. And I did the thing that science kids do, which is see the high mark and correlate it with, I'll probably like do well at this.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to be honest, like I did get lucky to an extent, excuse me, which is like, I sort of just took a shot at it. I said, I mean, I really enjoy doing this course. And if I don't do it, I think I'm going to regret it. I'm going to regret the choices that I don't make. So I went into it, and I'm outing myself, I guess, politically here, but I took a course with Jordan Peterson, and that was sort of he was tossing some concepts at me, Jungian and Freudian and existential philosophy and psychology, and I had never heard of these things before, and I found myself not knowing what to do. I was like, this isn't the multiple choice that I'm used to. It's right, not asking me like A, B, C. And so basically, long story short, a little bit of philosophy came into it, changed my life. And here we are in clinical psych. I knew that it wasn't going to be medical school. I knew that I liked this forum of conversation. I enjoy talking to you, and that's, I enjoy talking to people. And that's what I want to do on a daily basis. It doesn't get me tired at all.
Yeah. When did that, for both of you, I mean, that desire to help, like, when did you guys first recognize that? Because that's obviously not something that everybody will kind of get to. You know, at what point in your lives did you say like, yeah, this is something that's a part of who I am fundamentally?
Oh man. Such a good question. Like, I don't know necessarily exactly how far back it goes. I know for sure that that desire was definitely strengthened, you know, during that like long stretch of time from like 20 to 26 when I had those philosophical musings. But like, I think it goes back much further to like my Christian upbringing, I guess, and really identifying with like the Christ archetype. I'm not like religious anymore, but like, I guess that archetype, like growing up, you know what I mean? And having, and like seeing this archetype over and over and over again, and being told that, you know, dying for people's sins and dying for people's suffering, right, yeah, miraculously helping people, just, I guess, like just seeped so far into my being that it's like something that I just act out now. I would say that's probably where it derives from.
Interesting. Okay.
Oh, that's a that sort of sets up me to sort of give you a lamer answer for me. That was beautiful.
Sorry.
That was really great.
It was. Mine is more like when I found out that it's myself. It's when I realized I really lose myself, which is a little bit paradoxical. I lose myself in what I'm doing and what I'm thinking about these concepts. So I become a part of a greater whole, and I don't see Alan as Alan anymore. And I, you know, go into this vortex, and time isn't time anymore. And so for 6 or 8 hours or 10 hours, I'm able to do something without getting the least bit tired, without being exhausted and actually loving it. And that flow experience sort of coming up out of nowhere. And the more I was mining that ore, it was just like, it was just giving me gold over and over again. And it's like, this has got to be it. I don't know. I mean, could there potentially be something else? We can't write off that potentiality, but I think for now, I'm pretty happy that it's working over and over again. And I identify with it as strongly as you can.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I would say it's funny. I really resonate with that idea of kind of finding that flow. It was like even half an hour ago, I was sitting on my bed. I was looking over that email that you had sent me. I was kind of doing a little bit of, you know, packing away a little research on the different kinds of therapies and stuff, which we'll get into. And I thought of it, and I was just like sitting there, and I'd had kind of, as I said, one of those busy kind of blasé days. And I was like, you know what? I really like, I on the surface, I don't feel like I really want to talk to people tonight. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, yeah. I could just sit down and chill and do nothing. But then, you know, I really thought about it. And when I'm on these calls, when I'm talking with people, when I'm learning about this world, you do. It is like everything else. Nothing else is mattering. Like, you just kind of really zone in. So I completely get that. You can like, I could work on a podcast for 6 hours and it'd be like a blink of an eye. And you're like, oh, wow. All right.
Like, it's because you're passionate, you know, about it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, the reason that I wanted to ask you guys about when you recognize that that desire to help other people, I think that a lot of people, from what I've seen and through myself, I've found a lot of solace through healing my own pain, through helping with, you know, talk through others' pain, with the podcast, with people who reach out to me through DM or whatever it may be. Speaking about my experiences and helping other people and kind of making that connection is something that helps me heal. So I was kind of curious if either of you have ever had that kind of mental illness, mental health background where you've experienced that pain that now you help others deal with.
And I mean, feel free to jump in at any point if what I'm saying sparks something for you. For me personally, it was, originally my background is Persian. So that's, you know, there's this big move that happens and you come to Canada, and for anyone who's been through the immigration process, it's sort of like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, sort of like, yeah, if you know, you know, sort of thing. Which is, it takes, I don't know who told me an estimate of, it takes about 10 years to sort of get really fully settled in as a actually full-fledged Canadian citizen. And I was thinking back, it's been about 15 or so years now. They were fully right. It took about 10 years until the anxieties and the worries and the the depression, which I may not have necessarily experienced on a day-to-day basis that I identified with, but it's constantly sort of low flame hanging in the background where you think, crap, are we going to be like fine?
Right, is it, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, is there like a net under us? Like, are we okay? And for someone to think about that all the time, it's not necessarily entirely pleasant. And, you know, you might be able to see why I tend to go now towards more, you know, existential thoughts and like wanting to talk with people about these, is because you do start to think about the givens of existence. Like, what does it mean even for me to be doing this? Like, why did we move here? Like, sure. I mean, like, yeah, you want a better life and you want a safer life, but apart from all of that, what does that even mean? What is a good life? Like, why am I struggling all this time? Wouldn't it have just been so much easier to just hang out with people that I knew way back in the day? But right, so why? So you really start to think about the toil that you're going through, and then you want to help it make sense for others as well. And so that's sort of the way I choose to look at it.
Yeah, I get that for sure. That, wow. Actually, you know what? I don't get that. I'm not going to pretend to get that. I get, you know, the concept of it, but the actual lived experience, I could never relate to. That's really interesting. Yeah, thank you.
So I guess I'll jump in here, and you know, I've me and Alan and I have talked about this a lot, like in our offices. We always talk to each other about these sorts of things. So
bit of a flex, but that's fine.
Hey, you're invited, dude.
You don't have your own office, Kyle? What?
Dude, welcome to my office. This is
it's the, nicer the whole, than our
the
office.
Home office. Yeah, fair enough.
You at least have like a fridge and a bathroom, dude.
Right. Yeah.
but yeah, like Alan and I have talked about this a lot. Like, I've heard his story, he's heard my story, and although on the surface there's not much to resemblance, you know what I mean? I think on a deeper level there is a sort of like existential resemblance. I know we keep bringing up existentialism, but it's a common theme between me and Alan to talk about this stuff. Mm-hmm. But I guess for me, I mean, I like, you know, I don't want to go on for 30 minutes or whatever, but yeah, I've had my like fair share of suffering. You know, I've had a lot of like debilitating health issues. And like, it's gotten to a point now where like, I'm almost expecting the future to be filled with like, you know, suffering that derives from medical issues. Like, I have a heart condition. I've had like issues with my tendons. I've had like stomach issues, like, you know, where I've had to have procedures and stuff like that.
Just all that fun stuff, eh?
Oh yeah. Yeah. it's great. But, like simultaneously, you know, alongside that, there's been a lot of mental illness in my family. And I won't go too deep into it just yet, but definitely contending with that suffering and like really dealing with it, I've gotten to like dark places, you know what I mean? And like, I've like entered the abyss, you know, so to speak, and like felt as though existence was a type of hell or like a punishment of sorts.
Yeah.
And that's something that, you know, even though I'm sort of out of that abyss, it's still like a thought that like, you know, rings through my mind from time to time. And one of the things again that I want to do is like, again, help anybody that feels that life is a hell and sort of help them through that.
Yeah. That's powerful stuff, man. I do understand that, that life's a hell kind of thing. And I think so many people who have suffered with mental health issues do. And let's talk about existentialism for a second, because for me personally, it has been one of the scariest things that I've dealt with throughout my mental health journey. It's been one of those things that with OCD and with some anxiety, kind of this really great, fun 1-2 punch. You know, the OCD kind of brings up some thoughts, which lead to other thoughts, which lead to other thoughts. You kind of go down these really crazy rabbit holes. And then the anxiety kind of like just keeps that wheel spinning pretty, you know, and it gets all crazy and out of hand, and you feel this out of this sense of being out of control. And for people, I know in my experience, that can be a tough thing to come to grips with, that there is no control. There is nothing that, you know, we can only do so much. Our level of control is so minuscule in the grand scheme of things. And so I'm curious, like, what was that process with accepting existentialism, with learning more about it? Were you guys always as open and willing to talk about it? Was it something that caused anxiety? Like, talk me through a little bit of your experience with existentialism.
Oh yeah, dude, it still causes me anxiety. It's still like, I almost feel at times like I'm just, you know, clinging to existentialist thought just as a way out of like the anxiety, just as a way out of, you know, existence as a sort of a hell. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's something I continually contend with and something I continually grapple with on a day-to-day basis. But I feel like it's offered me a lot of solace, a lot of like control and a lot of responsibility on myself, as opposed to living in a world where everything is out of your control. Existentialism sort of shifts it around. There's a Copernicus shift and it gives you that control back. You know, you're in control of your life. You got to take responsibility for certain things. You know what I mean? And I think that can help a lot of people. It won't help everyone. It's not a perspective for everybody, but I think like really shifting that and giving the person back their responsibility and the control over their life can do wonders for a lot of people, I think.
But there's also, I also think, and what you're saying, there's, I really like you saying it won't help everybody, because you're talking about, anxiety and OCD. And if someone comes in and they're having, for example, to a therapy session and they're having pretty bad bout of anxiety, it would be straight up irresponsible to toss existential concepts at them. It'd be like, just, hey man, just get a grip. Just get a grip and realize that we're all gonna die, that you're alone, that it's all essentially meaningless. And like, I mean, the dude is gonna be like, what are you talking? I mean, my heart's racing, and I'd probably leave
around that point, I think.
Exactly. So I think, and Jeremy and I fight about this all the time, you know, in a very academic fashion. We sort of have different fears within existentialism that we're sort of drawn towards. I think, you know, whether it's meaninglessness, isolation, freedom, or death, we talk about this all the time. And for myself, it might have to be freedom. Might have to be isolation. He's talked about meaninglessness. I know his research focuses on that and death. And so it's not like one cookie cutter package, but just the sort of realization that ultimately, even us two who like think about it all the time, and we sort of have a very academic reason to even do it, we can't get out of it. Like if I really let myself at 2 a.m. sit there and think about it long enough, I'm going to start hyperventilating. And that's just me being honest. Like that, it will happen.
The witching hour.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. It's funny that you bring that up, Alan. Like, first of all, I'm in complete agreement with you. You know, existentialism is not for everybody. And I think that's why you and I, you know, promote the idea, at least within like our cohort, of like being an integrative therapist, someone that draws from multiple frameworks that can help people in different ways, right? For someone who is suffering from OCD, existentialism is probably the last thing on their mind, right? You know what I mean? So I'm in full agreement with you there. And as for like the ability to step away from existential thought, I can't say I'm with you on that. I can't stop thinking about like these things. Even if I try, you know, in a way it's sort of rumination. I'll just be laying there in bed and like, I can't turn it off. I just fall asleep. You know what I mean?
How deep would you say, and this is a bit, I feel like this question answers itself a little bit, but like I don't even know if I want to ask it. I was going to say like, how deep can existentialism go within the actual psychology community? Because like, I figure it's one of those things that there are only so many conclusions that you can come to about everything, and basically if you're going to talk about existentialism, you are talking about everything, and you know, how much can you boil it down? I guess there's an infinite ways in which you could boil it down to just one thing. Like, I don't know. I guess that's just kind of like, how have you guys seen people, different approaches to existentialism?
I get it. I mean, I'll simply say, you know, without going off on a tangent, is that existentialism is still highly limited, right? Again, I don't think any specific framework any specific framework doesn't do the depth of the human condition justice, right? I think you need all of them. It's like a it's like a collage. It's like a sort of a stained glass window. You take all of these frameworks, and the picture is the human, right? Mm. So I think at the end of the day, existentialism is limited, vastly, you know what I mean? I don't think it would help someone necessarily who has like a biological schizophrenia, for example.
Hmm. And it's something that I always want to make sure that people know, is that, you know, through the, I guess, propagation of movies and everything, and how it's portrayed in, I guess, pop culture and the zeitgeist, if you look at something like therapy, and we're talking like maybe the highest level, I guess, you've done your due diligence, you've been trained, and you're now a doctor in psychology. It's a completely different model than like the medical field, where the medical field is, I broke my leg and I really need help. And all of the medical field goes, well, there's one procedure for that.
Right.
And there's truly just one procedure for that. Whereas if you come in and you go, I don't know what I want to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many different ways can you come at that? You can come at it through like a cognitive framework where you talk about your thoughts. You can come at it through like an emotional way where you talk about, no, how does that feel? You know, describe how that feels. Mm. You can come at it existentially and just go right into the deep end. But like you said, to speak to your point as well, it's such an all-encompassing thing where the second you sort of broach the topic, you're immediately talking about the greatest issues in human existence. You're immediately also talking about death.
Yeah.
So it's uncomfortable. It's not nice and cute and cuddly and doesn't fit into a package of people want to even talk about all the time. And that unfortunately has caused its discussion to be a little bit on the edges the past 40, 50 years, at least in my knowledge, in my estimation.
Where would you guys say, I mean, thinking about existentialism, like that's an element of psychology that I wouldn't immediately jump to when I think of, you know, kind of like how you approach certain, you know, how when people come in and talk to you about certain things that are going on in their life, the last thing that I'm kind of thinking is looking at it from this giant framework. What do you guys feel are some misconceptions that have kind of been played out, whether it is through media or just kind of word of mouth per se, or people who don't really know the scope of what they're talking about, misconceptions around the field of psychology that you guys have witnessed?
So that's a great question. That's something I think about as well, because it really affects how, when I meet, for example, someone new, there's always a question of, when do I choose to tell them that that's the field I'm in? Because it's so important in the media, and it's been portrayed since, you know, forever. When you think of psychologists, you think of a cigar, white beard, someone laying back, and so Freud. And
right.
And it's difficult because it's so hard to have people not think that when they're saying something to me, I am not analyzing them. That's not what's happening in my head. So that's one of the things, is people are immediately on guard when they're talking to me, because it's like, I don't want to give him that nugget that he will later use to like, you know, put in his conceptualization of who I am. And I don't want to give him puzzle pieces. And it's just like, man, I'll be honest with you. I'm not interested in doing that with everyone. I'm not at work. And right. B, and this is something probably Jeremy can speak to, that's not what our work even is. And Jeremy, I don't know if you want to go off of that as well. I know you're passionate about that.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And like, exactly. I've gotten to this point where I like almost don't even want to say like what I'm like pursuing. just because, yeah, there's so many like preconceived notions of what that entails. Like they automatically sort of, you know, label you with like all these different things that you're doing. Like I've had numerous times met new people and go like, oh, like I'm pursuing clinical psychology, and right off the cusp, they're like, you're analyzing me, aren't you?
Right, right.
And like, I joke around with it. Like, I don't really care. You know what I mean? I think it's kind of funny, but at the same time, it's like, I'm just chilling. You know what I mean? I'm not really doing that. And again, that's not really what we do. I would say maybe another misconception is like that psychotherapy itself is merely selling advice as a product, right? And that's not necessarily what it is. In fact, advice rarely plays a part in psychotherapy. You know, as a therapist, I mean, again, it depends on what framework you're coming at, or like what framework you're using within the therapeutic setting. But a lot of it is like being there for the clients and providing empathy and really trying to understand who they are as a person, and sort of like what the like the sort of the depth of their presenting concerns, right? As well as providing sort of an authentic relationship for you two to, you know, the therapist and the client to sort of like delve deeper into understanding what's going on in the client's life. And, you know, again, that's just like a fraction of what therapy is. But it's rarely advice giving. I mean, at least in my experience, I don't think I've even really offered advice to the clients that I've seen. Client, I've only seen one client. Keep that in mind.
It's interesting, Jeremy, to hear you say that clinical psychology, that you're not in the advice giving department. Like that's not, you know, you're not peddling advice. And to be a bit anecdotal for a sec here, I know that the moment that kind of changed my life, that made me, you know, go down this kind of try to get mentally healthier, go down this path, was I went to a therapist at Ryerson as part of, you know, they had a really great therapy program there. And basically I went and saw this therapist, and I sat down, and I basically, it was one of the first people that I had ever opened up to about all the stuff that had went on in my life, basically just really poured everything out to her. And it was just kind of one of those things where like, you kind of got that vibe from her, like everything. I'd seen psychologists and therapists before, but I hadn't really clicked with anybody yet. And so with her, you know, from the first few minutes, I really got this like good vibe from her. I opened up to her, and instead of, which other therapists had before, instead of trying to kind of just say, hey, here's almost like the fix, and thus to me reinforcing the idea that I was in some way innately broken, she kind of sat back and was like, you know what? It sounds really hard. And it was so casual, and it was so light and easy. And it was just like years of all of this weight was just kind of like a little bit of it was kind of chipped away, because somebody kind of validated that pain. I'd never really wanted to open up to my family because I was worried what they would, you know, what they would think. They provided me with this incredible life, and now I'm this miserable, depressed, you know, angsty teenager with all these mental health things going on. I'm like, oh, that's not fair to them. I didn't want to burden my friends or anything. And to have her validate that and just say, hey, you know what? Yeah, it sounds kind of shitty. It was like, yeah, thank you. Like that's exactly what it is. So yeah, I'm just kind of curious, like, what would you guys, you know, how do you go about guiding somebody, and how do you guys go about the process of being a psychologist, a therapist, you know, when it comes to seeing patients and hopefully giving them a little bit of that sense that I just hopefully somehow explained.
Quickly, just to like speak on your experience, I think what you said is super powerful, which is sometimes you just need to have someone else acknowledge the suffering that you've been through. Mm-hmm. You know, we go through our lives carrying all this suffering around, every single one of us. We all bear this suffering on our shoulders. And, you know, a lot of times it remains just with us. And there's a lot of power in being able to share that your story of suffering with another person and have them sit there and go, you know what? Yeah, you suffered, mm-hmm. and that's fine. Like, it's not fine really because you suffered, but I acknowledge that you suffered, right. and you're still valuable. You're still a human, and you're still important. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally.
There's something so powerful about another person acknowledging your suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I just wanted to emphasize
totally. That. And the other thing too is not, And what I've seen a lot of is not saying, oh, I get it completely, which I'm guilty of sometimes. People say certain things and I'm like, I totally understand. And sometimes it just slips out to the, you know, to the detriment sometimes of the conversation or that bond. But just saying like, listen, I don't understand really what you've went through, but yeah, that sounds really hard, is a really powerful thing. And it's not something that I think you need a psychology degree to do for the people in your life sometimes.
Which, no, you definitely, yeah. You do not need a psychology degree. And I think it's so important that you're saying that about just the normal conversation and the bond of the conversation being the need to sort of want to reach out and say, no, I totally get it, which we all do, by the way. Jeremy and I still do that quite often. No, I totally get it. Like, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But that's, I would say those are the things we get trained on, right? In school, are those little minute things. So those are the things that they tell us to sort of be aware of and be in the moment about when we're in session with a client, is to really be aware that what's happening in the moment is like sort of sacred. Mm-hmm. And to not say, to not, I guess, minimize their feeling and their existence, what they've been through in their lives. If they're really hurt because of an argument with their friend, that's just as valid in their mind and in their mode of being as someone who has lost a parent. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sort of the judge sitting there saying, bro, I just saw someone last hour who lost their parent, and you're talking to me about being like kind of sad that like Melissa isn't speaking to you or something. And it's just like, that's not for me to decide. Mm-hmm. What I have to do is sort of, and that's really the healing stuff in session. It's not me talking about your thoughts or emotions or whatever. It's me understanding, like you said. That's why I like the anecdote you brought up. It's someone going, yeah, I understand. Not experience wise, I can never be Kyle, but I can attempt to get a flavor of what you've been through and really tell you, shit, man, that was bad. I'm sorry that's what went through that moment in your life. And I acknowledge that.
And just also to add on to that, like Alan was basically saying, you know, you can't compare suffering, right? You can't, especially as a therapist, but I think that this would be helpful for a lot of people to do as well, is sort of eradicating that process that we all do of like comparing each other's suffering. Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, my suffering's worse than your suffering. Like as therapists, I think it's important for us to learn that, you know, suffering is universal in that everyone feels it, but the degree of suffering is again, it's relative. Mm. So that's something so important to recognize, is, you know, that lack of judgment, that lack of judgment. It's huge, yeah. Being a therapist.
And also, I mean, I think the flip side as well too, somebody always has it worse. You know, I hear that a lot of the time, people really invalidating their suffering by saying, oh, but I know somebody else has it worse. They are the people who, you know, in Alan's example, who it's like, I know Melissa's not talking to me and that makes me really upset, but I know that somebody just lost their dad probably somewhere in the world. And who am I to be upset about this thing, when really, I mean, it seems like all you'd be doing is just pushing your suffering down. You're kind of compounding it essentially. And the more and more that you do that, all of a sudden that I feel like that's kind of where some trauma comes in the sense of just like a ton of unsolved pain.
Right. And it's one of the things, I mean, that's always been admirable to me when people do it, because I understand and recognize that at the core of it, there's this drive to want to make their friend feel better. If it's just even friends, not therapists talking. And we've all done it. And I want to stress, I continue to do it. I don't want to come across as some like saint I continue to do it, but I just have gotten better at catching myself doing it a little bit more. Right. I think that's the difference. And it's like the whole, like when you're out with a friend, you get some food, you don't finish it, and they go, hey man, there are people starving. And it's like, that's absolutely true. But because like this is completely relative to this moment in time. You know what I mean? We can take care of that with a different avenue. We can come at that through so many different means, but that's the thing. People want to just reach out and say, someone always has it worse. Exactly. Like you said, Like, don't you think that you should stop moping? Like, come on, man. Like, there's so many people who like can't even read or can't even see or can't. And it's like, yeah, it's fair. But then what am I supposed to just completely shove everything down, become numb and say someone has it worse? What kind of living experience is that?
Well, I mean, and we're really living in the time of somebody always has it worse. We're in Corona times. Everyone's there's always somebody who has it worse. And everybody right now is experiencing this level of sadness, isolation, depression, you know, however you'd want to characterize it and whatever that they're going through uniquely. But yeah, there's always somebody who's losing their grandmother and they're having to watch her, you know, over Skype. Like, and now those things exist, but at the same time, like it's a perspective. And I've always kind of thought about it, like, you know, that perspective thing to really kind of take you out of some out of control thinking. Sometimes, you kind of stop yourself a little bit, you kind of slow the raging horse. But I think also sometimes it almost is weaponized against yourself kind of thing. This self-detrimental mindset of, well, I can't express myself and I can't show that this is bothering me because I don't want to be the bad guy because I'm feeling bad. It's an interesting kind of, I don't know if you'd call it a paradox, I guess, but just kind of like that looped thinking. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, you know, you guys talked a little bit about having patience and how you guys go about that, but how are you guys feeling when you're seeing patients? I know, Alan, we talked very briefly and I said, I got to hold this because I want to save it for the episode before we started about, you know, the idea that you are very much in control of this person's most intimate, maybe scary thoughts, and they are confiding in you when maybe you're the only person who they're confiding these things in. I mean, how does it play on your mental health? Like, what's going through your mind when you know that you have to be careful of every word you say and your actions are going to have an impact on this person? I'm just kind of curious from that therapist point of view.
Want the real version or do you want like the nice diplomatic version?
Come on, I mean you know.
I think Jeremy, you want to go for, I think, did you have the most recent session today or did I?
My session was from 12 to 1. I think yours is after mine.
Okay, go, right? You've had some time to digest, you go first.
I mean, I thought today's session was good, but so it didn't take too much of a toll on me, but I've had, again, I can't get into details.
Yeah
right. I can't say, you know what I mean? I can't say too much about it. I can say that there are certainly times in, you know, the therapeutic arena where it takes a huge toll on me because one, I'm an apprentice. I am an amateur. I want to stress that I have had one client, you know what I'm saying? Like I am just an apprentice. I'm an amateur. I'm learning this stuff, and I'm still self-critical about not knowing a lot of the things that I think I should know or I expect myself to know as someone who has someone's not life in my hands. It's not really the same. That's not right to say that. It's more like, again, what Alan is saying, that you might be the only person they're confiding in, right? And they're putting their trust in you that you can help them, right? And so it's this weird, like, I jump back and forth between like, oh, I'm an apprentice. So I, you know, it's okay. I'm going to be, you know, not hard on myself because I don't know these things yet. I'm being taught these things, but at the same time, it's like, but this is a person, right? And I mean a lot to this person in this person's life and one slip up and who knows what could happen. So it does definitely take a toll on me sometimes.
I personally find that I need to do something else. I think it's also, like Jeremy said, we've been seeing one client we're in second year of master's. And then I think in the PhD program, we'll start to see multiple at once. But so far, I mean, I started in November and it's been all right. But even before that, I've, you know, my friends and our mutual friends that we all know, would say that the change in myself has become like, I've been quieter. Like I just, and I don't know what that, I don't know whether to attribute that to a negative or a positive. I've just been much quieter. Whereas like, there's some things where I would jump in and want to talk about all the time. It's almost like I have to conserve energy from certain discussions because I know that so much of my energy is going to be put into the therapy session. Right. So now I basically only have room to confide for like my close family and my best friends. So that's what's, you know, so like if those three or four people like want to talk to me, perfect, I'll talk to them. But it's, I've necessarily had to cut down, and it's so bad, but it's like I've necessarily had to cut down on like how much care I'm putting into certain relationships. And that's something that people don't necessarily always talk about. Like if I talk to you once every 5 months and you hit me up for emotional, like emotionally demanding advice, I can't necessarily always give that to you anymore. And I used to be able to. And I think that's the biggest toll that this is all taking on me, is I feel like I've had to like prune it down, if that makes sense, to conserve energy and mental health.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
if you don't mind, 100%. I'll just jump in here really quickly just to like, you know, add to what Alan was saying. Like, as I, this is sort of the perspective I'm coming to now, at least as like a budding therapist, is a therapist kind of has to like marry suffering. Right, there's it's like you throughout your life you're going to just have this intimate relationship with suffering, and you're going to hear some of the most like horrendous things, right? And the beauty in it is that, you know, you're there as sort of this like angel in their hell, and you're trying to like help them out of it, which is awesome. But again, you know, and this, you know, as a therapist, you kind of have to, what like Alan says, you got to take care of yourself. You got to take care of yourself. And if that means like pulling back a little bit from like demanding things in like your everyday life, I think you kind of got to do that, because your job is to be there for these people that are paying you money. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. And as somebody who's went to therapy, paying you guys a lot of money, first of all, so
I would say not nearly enough. Yeah. At some
which is fair. Hey, perspective is a beautiful thing. Yeah, I mean, when you guys are seeing a client for the first time, what is that process like to approach like what they're going through? Like, I mean, for instance, I'm a podcaster. When I am going to interview somebody, usually I have somewhat of a game plan, two or three bullet points of things I want to touch on. And then from there, I kind of let my intuition, I let my research, I let who I am as a person take a little, you know, take me where I want to go using this guideline. How would you guys describe the process of seeing somebody, and what's that therapy process look like?
I mean, that's huge. Like that intuition is also plays a massive role in therapy. Like it's, I think I like to view it as like a structured dance. Mm-hmm. I know Alan likes to think of it in terms of like jazz, you know, and music, but I see it sort of like structured jazz, where like you know, again, you learn, you know how to dance, but then, you know, you take it and you do sort of these impromptu motions as well. Again, the process is like, there's a lot to it. You got to do consent. You have to like, there's a whole bunch of things and administrative things that you have to do. But, you know, a lot of it is exploratory. A lot of it is sort of dancing with the client and you know, exploring with them, basically.
Dude, I mean, before you answer, Alan, I just want to say that's beautiful. I think that is such a great way of thinking about it. It's like a dance. It's a little give, little take. You know, you might be leading, but yet you're learning as you go. I think that's great. I think that's really cool.
It's a really good way to put it as well, because it really just underlines the fact that you don't really know what's going to happen. I know you're sort of asking specifically about like when you first start. And I would actually argue it goes on for literally every single session where you're seeing the client. You don't know what's happening, and that is the beauty of it. I think it takes a certain type of person to get into therapy, because you have to be okay with uncertainty. I've had these discussions with so many of my friends where they say, just give me one, tell me one, pick one, is it this or this? And I'm just like, no, I'm not picking a single one. I'm gonna stay right in the middle. I'm sitting on that fence, and I love my spot, looking at both sides from the fence. Sure, it's uncomfortable a little bit because the spikes are getting in my backside, but you know, it has its beauty as well. And so I think Jeremy also said, he mentioned, I like to look at it as jazz. That's what I see jazz as. So this talented musician who does so much hard work to learn everything. You know all the scales, you know all the greats. Now, once you get on stage and if there's a moment to riff, you're doing it and your soul is really informing what's coming out through that riff and that solo. And that's that happens often. That happened, and again, without going into too much detail, that went into, happened in my session today. I had this game plan. I knew what I was going to do. Client comes in and has something else on their mind. And I went, oh, I literally will not be able to touch on anything that I prepared for actually a week. So there goes out the window. Here we go. Let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm. So basically, for anybody who's listening, if you really want to throw your therapist a curveball, just completely different topics.
One session, actually one tell session. Them what happened. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you guys say? I know that therapy can be a very intimidating thing for some people. I've talked to so many people in my life. I've had so many people reach out to me who I've talked about my therapy process. It's been an incredibly beneficial thing. But it took some trial and error, give or take. You know, I had to see a couple different therapists before I found the one. For those listening audibly, I'm using bunny ears here. What would you guys say to people who are intimidated by the therapy process?
Well, I like your point on like finding the one, because I think that has to be emphasized. Like, you know, it's the same thing with friendships. You're not just going to be friends with anybody you meet. You're going to be friends with the person that you connect with, right? And therapy is kind of similar in a way. You kind of have to have like, there's the best friend and you kind of have to find your best therapist in a way. You know what I mean? Where like, there is that like real authentic relationship. There's, you guys kind of connect on like an emotional level, on like all these different levels. And like, that's when like the magic of therapy emerges, I think, when you find that, that best therapist, as I call it. But in the same way that like, there's magic in a best friendship, right?
It's also, I really appreciate, Kyle, that you're saying that, because it's a part of it, the process that people actually just don't know. So they think, you know, I go in and if it doesn't work, then it wasn't for me. And yeah. I think that's actually the mood with, I'm going to throw out a random percentage, but like the majority, like 80%, 85% of people think that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like Jeremy said, you really have to just kind of go, and sometimes it takes like maybe five or six even, which I thank God for that first consultation session. Otherwise you'd be paying a lot of money, but I think therapists usually give a free consultation session at the beginning. And they say, let's just see what happens. And you can sort of kind of see what their temperament is. If it's someone who's really like uppity, right? Mm-hmm. And they just go, did you do your homework? Did you do this?
Oh,
did you do
God. This? I'm having war flashbacks.
It's like, well, I mean, that's probably going to work for a certain type of person who wants order and everything in their lives and wants to be told what to do. Whereas some people are like, I don't get that sense with you. You kind of want this conversation. You want a good flowing thing where you kind of get out what's on your mind. They sort of even sometimes potentially say things that's happened in their lives.
Yeah.
They're a true, genuine person. You got to kind of like date, you know what I mean? So you got to go on these dates and see what happens until you find your sort of long-term one.
Mm-hmm. I always, every therapist that I've ever went to, this is from the time that I've been grade like 6, 7, all the way up to university. I always asked every therapist why they wanted to become a therapist. That was kind of like my, you know, like my, like, what star sign are you question on like a, on the first on like the first date, like that was always just the kind of thing that like asking, you know, why'd you want to get into therapy? I want to know, I want, before I give you any intimate details about my life, I want to know where you're at. And for me, like, that was always kind of like how I would gauge it. But yeah, I mean, definitely, like, I'm such a proponent for, yeah, you do have to try a bunch, like, therapy's for everybody. You should do therapy just like you know, you would the dentist, where it's like, you know, even if you're nothing wrong with your teeth feel fine, you're still going to go in for a biannual checkup, you know, kind of just make sure nothing's really, you know, weighing heavy on your mind. There aren't any unhealthy patterns that are developing, anything like that. And then if you do have a toothache or a cavity or something like that, you're going to go more often. And so that's always the way that I've approached. And I think it also makes it a little bit more understandable for people, because I think too, and this is what I've seen, people who are a little bit older as well, I feel like therapy is becoming a lot more of a normalized thing among Gen Z and millennials. However, with this older generation, our parents, our grandparents, therapy was something that was not only, you know, kind of frowned upon a little bit, but it was really seen as this, it was this big extreme thing. And so I would kind of say, like, people who don't want to necessarily go because they think it might be admitting that something's wrong with them. And that's a scary thing to think that who they are is flawed. I mean, would you guys be able to touch on that mindset at all?
Yeah. I mean, it's something that I'm taking a lot of heart out of seeing it slowly change. Slowly, very slowly, but surely, I think necessarily. But, you know, it's hard to move away. I always like to imagine myself being sort of 50 and having to listen to the music of the time then. And that's how I like to sort of put it in my head. And already I'm an old man. I'll hear something and I'll be like, oh, what is this? Isn't music. Like, and it happens a lot, way more than my other friends. So it doesn't bode well, but I try to keep open-minded. But that's the sort of thing that you gotta kind of go for with the older crowd as well. Like, you gotta realize that to them, it was like, if you went to therapy, you were crazy. And that's it. You were just crazy. Like, and that's what they called it. You were either crazy or insane, and you deserve to be in an asylum. We have moved past that. A good chunk of us, at least the people that are our age bracket, are Gen Z millennials. And they know that it's exactly like you said, it's like a dentist. If it hurts, you go in. You're not going to be like, well, but what if someone sees me entering the complex? Yeah. And what if they see me come out with like my little goodie bag with my toothbrush and everything?
Right.
That doesn't happen. And so it shouldn't happen here as well. But there's still such hush hush. And I guess, I mean, that's a huge point of your podcast as a whole, which is really good, is to like normalize it and continue to do so, especially even for guys. Because I see it a lot more with guys, honestly, than I do with girls. Girls seem to be okay with saying, yeah, I mean, I just went or whatever. Yeah. And everyone goes, yeah, okay, that was another appointment in the day. Whereas guys sort of like look behind them, you know what I mean? And they check the premises to
They've
see
got
if
like the collar popped. Like, the hat on.
And then they're like, yes, I saw my therapist today. And it's like, oh. But yeah, you would hope that it becomes more normal as time goes by. That's all I can really say about that.
Yeah, I totally agree with what Alan's saying. And again, I'm like, just want to speak to the fact that I think it's becoming more understandable in you know, Gen Z and, you know, with the millennials and everything, that like, you know, life can just be hard. And it doesn't mean you're disordered. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with you. It's just life is difficult. I would say there should be an opportunity for people to, meet with someone and deal with the struggles of life without being, you know, judged or labeled as disordered. So I think that, you know, I think it's a fantastic thing that that's becoming sort of like the norm.
Yeah. I certainly hope it will continue to do that. I know it is one of those things where I had a conversation the other day with the Canadian Mental Health Association's New Brunswick chapter. We had talked, and they're gonna do some work with the podcast. I'm gonna do some work with them, which is amazing, and I'm super excited about that. And they were talking about how normalizing it within young men, you know, this conversation going to therapy, is interesting, like is important. But I found it interesting in just kind of thinking about, man, if I was 50 and saw my podcast, I would hate it. Cause like, I would be like, who is this foul mouthed maritimer talking about therapy and all, and, you know, masculinity and all of these things that were so like ingrained for so long in their minds. I mean, I guess like, I don't know if this is even the question for this group. I mean, we're four guys or three guys in our 20s. Like, you know, how do you guys see, or how have you seen people go about introducing like that older generation to therapy? I know that that's kind of a very similar question to what we just went over, but if you guys were, let's say, going to put like guide your parents or your grandparents to therapy, knowing what you know from a clinical standpoint, how do you think you would do that? Because I know that there are a lot of people who, they are kids who have dealt with their parents having unresolved trauma, whether it's from their grandparents or whatnot, and they would love to be able to say, hey, mom, or hey, dad, or uncle, or grandma, or whatever, I think that you should go to therapy. But they don't want it to come off as harsh or judgmental. So, you know, how would you guys go about that?
That is a great question, and not something that I've pondered too much, to be honest with you. But it's a great question. Like, I think it's important for the younger generation to sort of introduce these concepts and these ideas to the older generation, whether that be their parents or their grandparents. How to go about doing that is certainly a challenge. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure if I can like provide any like specific like ways of doing that, again, because everyone's parents are different. Yeah. And everyone's grandparents are different. And I'm not sure. Maybe let me throw this one to Alan, because I'm not sure, to be honest with
you. There's so many different aspects to it though, right? Like, I think the personality aspects of like the parents, like Jeremy said, mm-hmm. are key, or the adults, we'll say. But I mean, you got to think about so many different aspects. Like, culture is a huge thing that I think comes in. I know certain cultures, and I know this from personal experience and from having talked to friends, it's certain cultures, it's way more frowned upon mm-hmm. than it would be in any other ones. But it's like, how would you do it? Would a nice video help? Like a nice, like a kind of a, hey, this is your first day in therapy sort of like video. Mm-hmm. What about a book or something that has a nice, I think analogies are super important. Always. The dentist thing always comes up, yeah. and you've got to have a nice analogy and a metaphor that you can throw to someone, because nothing is more transformative in the moment for and helpful to understanding than a metaphor or an analogy. Mm-hmm. And if you hit the right one and they go, oh, it really is like that, isn't it? That does way better than about 15 hours of statistical or scientific information and explanation. So mm-hmm. if the dentist thing you find works, and there's problems with that, because as we discussed, the dating aspect is there to therapists.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's always a setback. But if you find the right analogy, I think you're golden. What that is, I haven't really found. I've been blessed enough to have like open discussions with my parents, but that doesn't, you know, get rid of the fact that we do need to have something. And unfortunately, yeah. I think it's something that each person has to find for themselves, for their situation.
Yeah. Yeah. It is one of those things. And I notice this with the podcast a lot. And again, with therapy, with everything, it's like, there's no fixing. There is no, it's just kind of like a lot of shared experience, a lot of empathy, a lot of like really connecting with each other. And that's the biggest thing. And then from there, you start to see some progress and some steps being made, because, you know, things aren't as scary when you're not alone in the feelings, or when those feelings finally get validated. So I think that's great. I do have one last question to ask you guys, if you guys still have the time.
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
Amazing. With anybody that I have on the podcast, I like to give my listeners a challenge. Something basically that through your lived experience, your clinical experience, your education, something that they can implement into their day, their week, their month, their life, something that can help them, whether it might be start therapy or just kind of go on and start this healthier lifestyle or start down their mental health journey. If you guys were going to put forth a challenge, what would it be? If you're good, I'll start with Jeremy.
Sure. Yeah. Something just popped in my mind, and it's something that through the process of like, you know, getting my first clients and like actually, you know, engaging in the process of becoming a therapist, it's transformed me a lot, which is try empathy, right? I challenge you to try empathy. And what that is, I mean, you know, there's a lot of definitions. There's a lot of conceptualizations of what empathy is in the psychological arena, but it can be boiled down simply to try to understand the other person's perspective. Mm. Really sit down and try to understand the other person's perspective, whether that's, you know, your family members or your friends or someone you don't like or your professors or your boss, anybody. Try to listen to them and try to understand their perspective. And I think, you know, that would be the challenge I pose to your listeners.
I love that.
That's really nice. Well, first of all, that's an amazing one. So I give all of my support to that one. But There's one that's more personal, and I mean, any of our friends who are listening to this will groan immediately because I'm about to shill shamelessly. But
I already know what it is.
It's to read fiction. It's to read fiction at least a little bit. Not every single day, if you don't want to. That's what I challenge. But do at least maybe 5 or 10 pages, and I mean fiction. I don't mean nonfiction, because nonfiction is nice and it teaches you a lot of things. But fiction is the one that does all the work underground, and it introduces you to so many perspectives about the human condition. And, you know, before entering the clinical psychology program, I remember asking my supervisor, how do I prep? And she said, just keep reading fiction. And wow, that was something that I was already doing at that point. And it was like, oh, that's so I get to keep doing what I love, because nothing will take you to 18th century France to understand that person's toil. And to, like, you know, 20th century South Africa, you won't understand more about the human condition as a whole unless you read. And that's something that it's dying out. And it's something that all therapists are encouraged to do. I don't know how many actually do it, but, you know, Jeremy and I try to. But I would say that's probably the most important thing, to try to understand how humans suffer, how humans get better, and how our relationship is all we have. And to sort of encourage the growth of love.
Wow. Guys, two unreal challenges. That's like, I really appreciate that. Thank you. The challenges is something that is definitely really special to me. So I know that this is something that I would always kind of give myself challenges when I was going through those like dark spots. If it was just like, hey, you know, get out of bed and do one thing today. But do that for a week. And then all of a sudden it kind of, you build a lifestyle around it and things got a lot better. So I always try to put that forward. I think, you know, who you guys are as people and as therapists, I think you guys are going to be incredible in that field and make people feel very comfortable and, you know, relate to who they are as people and what they've been through in this, you know, shared 21st century. So yeah, I really appreciate you guys reaching out and coming on. And this has been, trust me, I only wrote down like a couple of questions. I love, you know, it's cool to talk shop with guys who know so much more than me. I love that. So yeah, I really appreciate it. And yeah, all the best, guys. Really.
Thanks for having us on, man. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, dude, you've been a fantastic host. I love what you're doing here. And, you know, you took my podcast virginity. So hey,
that's, thank you. That's going up on my wall. possibly Tinder bio, but we'll discuss that. Yes, dude.
Just the boys talking about therapy. Just phenomenal.
I don't know how we're going to do it, but somehow Life's Rec is going to make therapy sexy.
Okay, again. See, the fact that you said that, I have my doubts. Don't know if you're the guy to make it happen, but I like where your head's at. I like where your head's at, big guy.
You going to, do you want to give your take on the episode?
Nah, man, I'm good.
Come on, I know you want to do this. It's like your thing, you know, you make fun of me, then you hop onto some real profound shit about the episode, and I'm always like, wow, man, that's great. So, please.
Yeah, but it makes you happy when I do that, so I just don't wanna.
Okay, man. Yeah, no problem. You know, I'll just wrap it up. Guys, thanks for tuning in.
Fine. Okay, so first of all, the amount of times in my life that I've heard people be like, therapy's not for me, you know, that BS. Like, first of all, it is. Go to therapy. It is not one size fits all. You do have to try a bunch of different therapists before you find, like we talked about in the episode, the one. But like, I love the fact that just who these guys are. Young, excited, fun men pursuing clinical psychology, and just talk to them, you know, how much they love it. Like, they're inviting and just great to be around. And more than anything, they're the same guys, like you said, that you'd be grabbing beers with if you were back in Toronto. Those guys are the future of psychology. And that gives me hope that, like, not only will we continue to normalize therapy, but people will literally be like, holy shit, I see myself in these guys. I don't know why I was ever like, therapy's not for me. And boom goes the dynamite. You're welcome.
Bravo. Good stuff, man.
Yeah, I do love that stuff. I can't lie.
You're good at it.
You know what? I'm in a really good mood today as well. We're good at it.
You know what? That's a good note to leave on. Just unreal episode. I'm buzzing right now. I'm just so stoked to get to have the guys on. And you know, with that being said, hey, you. Yeah, you. You know, who's still listening.
First of all, why?
Second of all, thank you. We love you.
And third of all, life's a wreck. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Nice rack.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.